I think that's the essence of the inclusive innovation and the participatory design approaches, is to really continuously ask the question, who should be speaking? Who's the expert? Who should be leading? And how do I create more space while recognizing power imbalances that already exist between the people in the room?
Hi, and welcome to the Grateful Podcast. My name's Michelle Grant, and it's wonderful to have you here with us as we hear stories from women around the world working to build a more just, generative, and even joyful future on this planet. My guest on the show today is Anna Pantelich, and Anna and I actually met about 12 years ago when she was participating in a sustainable development training program that I was facilitating in Switzerland. And ever since that time, it's just been fascinating to watch the amazing career that Anna has had and the curiosity and drive and commitment that have taken her all over the world. And so I was really excited to sit down with her today and hear more about what she's been learning about life and leadership and everything in between on this amazing adventure that she's been on. Today, Anna is the executive director of the MIT D-Lab, and this is a group at MIT that's known around the world for its unique approach to participatory design and education, working with students and communities around the world to develop in a collaborative and participatory way practical solutions to the challenges of poverty. So MIT does this through around 15 interdisciplinary courses that they offer their students, research in collaboration with global partners, as well as technology development and community initiatives. And Anna came into this role after many years of working in international development. She specialized in poverty reduction through the lens of finance and has really focused on this intersection of technology and women's economic empowerment. And she's done some really interesting and impactful work in this space. She designed and led large-scale economic inclusion activities for women, like the first ever urban social protection program for adolescent girls in Uganda, which she set up as a part of her role at UNICEF in Uganda. Before that, she worked with a social enterprise called Fundación Capital, where she was the chief strategy officer and also the founder of an award-winning digital startup called Lista. And this has been proven to increase the financial health of women in poverty and has reached nearly 1 million low-income people across more than a dozen countries on 3 continents. Anna grew up in the former Yugoslavia and did her PhD in Serbia and, as a result, wrote a book called Disrupting Poverty in Developing Countries in Serbian. And this was the work that really kickstarted the fascinating career that she's had over the last 15 years. Today, I was really interested to talk with Anna about what designing for a more equitable world actually means and looks like in practice, what she's learned about working across both high and low resourced contexts, and how scarcity can fuel creativity, the overlap and the differences she's experienced between international development and sustainable development, two spaces her work inhabits, and what decolonizing both might mean. We also chat about what the overlaps between inclusive and participatory design and inclusive and participatory leadership look like. And finally, how she finds her joy and energy when depleted, which might just involve some singing and dancing. It was an absolute pleasure to chat with Anna, and I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. So in this role as the executive director of the MIT D-Lab, which has this really great tagline, designing for a more equitable future, can you tell me more about what's the essence of your work? What do you really focusing on? What do you hope to move forward through the D-Lab?
Sure. So D-Lab was started 20 years ago, really out of a particular need that was coming out of some of the perspectives of students. It was this desire to take this exceptional educational experience and put it to good use. You know, I think students really wanted to see how they might make an impact in the world. For some students that came from countries, you know, low income, low resource environments, they wanted to see how they could support people back home. And so, you know, the story goes that a student from Haiti asked the question of, well, what might we do in my country? And that really spun out a lot of the work and the projects and even the curriculum. And so some of the earliest engagements were around addressing environmental challenges in Haiti and students traveling to the country, speaking to people and understanding what their needs were, and then designing together with the community members some solutions. And I think this is one of the things that is, it's in MIT's DNA, mens et manus. It's the mind and hand, this hands-on learning approach that you have in engineering schools where it's not just about the theory, it's also how do we put this in practice. And so from those early days, we really started to see that students can have an incredible learning experience that's motivated beyond just the grades when they start to see their work come to life, when they start to see the impact that it has in communities. That's incredibly motivating. And my particular bias is that we don't work to address global poverty challenges because we're inherently good people or motivated by altruism. We do it because those are some of the most difficult problems. You find the greatest complexity in design constraints. So what do you do when you can't trust the electricity, when you don't know if you'll have power, when you don't know how strong it'll be, when you can't just order something off of Amazon? How do you work off of the existing environment and local skills? And so that, I think, makes for a better learning environment for students. And it also makes for more realistic and relevant solutions that are being designed within communities. And so that's sort of the story of D-Lab really stems from that. It stems not from this desire to kind of altruistically show that MIT is giving back in some way, but really for MIT to engage in a broader global perspective and work in some of the more challenging contexts and environments that stemmed from student desires, really. So it was really a demand-led program. And over the years, it's developed a lot, but that I think is still very much at the essence, that values-based approach and that conversation with communities.
As you're speaking, I'm imagining the students engaging with these types of programs and opportunities. And I'm wondering if through that work, it kind of shone a light on gaps they see in the rest of their education or other skills they've needed to build as they were being put into a context on the ground where they had to design for and lead change.
Yeah, I think maybe within the US context, there's not as much exposure to some of the realities around the world, or it's maybe not integrated in as visceral of a way. Particularly if you grew up in a city or in a suburban environment, you may not be exposed to some challenges around poverty, homelessness, et cetera. You may be a little bit separated from that, which I think it's good and bad in some ways, but it's the sense of realizing that the world has so much more to offer, realizing that there's so much more creativity that can come out of these design constraints. I think for students, one of the big things that they learn is soft skills. It's not just the hard skills of doing a problem set, knowing the math, but actually realizing that you can design the best solution, but if it requires certain inputs that you can't find locally, then your widget won't work. And that's one of the big things that they learn is when they start to travel and spend time in communities, it really opens their eyes to different cultures, different ways of living and thinking and working, but also just the realistic constraints around design that I think it activates their soft skills and their hard skills so that they learn how to listen better and they learn how to seek help and advice and input in a way that they might not have done otherwise, being, you know, typically being some of the smartest people in the room. We have that privilege of working with incredibly intelligent and well-trained students, and yet they can still learn more. And I think that's like, we're all hopefully lifelong learners. And I think wanting to learn more about the world, I think just is the quality of their work.
Yeah, and that's what sounds so beautiful about it. It's really this living lab to cultivate both. Well, I never really like the term soft skills because they're hard skills, but both the soft and the hard skills in combination. So at the D-Lab, you talk a lot about using inclusive innovation to tackle poverty. And I can imagine you have so many lessons learned and best practices from trying to implement this in real life. Could you share more about how you use inclusive and participatory approaches in the work that you do at the D-Lab?
I think a lot of this stems from the values that you have in terms of how you enter a space, how you engage with individuals. And with D-Lab, the origin story, again, stems from somebody from Haiti asking the question and inviting community engagement. And so from our earliest days, that was part of the process. But really, inclusive design means inclusivity in its broadest term. We tend to think that because somebody has expertise or is kind of designated as the designer or the project lead or the expert, that theirs is the only opinion that matters. And I think that this really hinders innovation and the sustainability of those innovations. And I'll say, going back a little bit to my background, in some ways I find myself as a bit of a cultural chameleon and being able to move between these different systems and cultures has given me really helpful insight in terms of the work that I do. So for example, growing up in Yugoslavia during the war and then after, there were a lot of charitable organizations, international development organizations with quote unquote experts who would come in and say, well, we know how to fix what's broken. And I kept thinking, we have highly capable, qualified individuals who absolutely know better. And you can't possibly know and understand our culture and our systems as an outsider, having not spent significant amount of time there. And so that was something that was really ingrained in me from an early age, is this understanding that there's, of course, value that can come in from external expertise. There's different perspectives. But at the end of the day, if you're not including the individuals who will ultimately own whatever solution you propose or you jointly design, then you're not doing your job and you're not doing well and you're not being respectful. You're not recognizing the agency that exists locally. So that approach that we take, this inclusive and participatory approach, we think of as a design continuum. We kind of define it as three stages where you start with design four. So where you say, I'll do some market research, I'll engage with communities in conversation, and I'll propose a solution based on those inputs. And so I will design a solution for this particular challenge. An advanced version of that is design with. That's sort of the co-design. These are all very big buzzwords, but it's essentially to say, let's be in the same space together and let's jointly work on designing a solution and we'll co-create whatever outcome together where we're both the designers. And then the final kind of step of that is design by, where you say, what do communities need to wear the hat of the designer, to be the designer themselves, to be the ones that are creating the solutions? And with certain technologies, you absolutely need a lot of training and skills. So this assumption that everyone can be a designer, that's the goal to aspire to, is not really accurate. It really just depends on the particular solution. And that continuum, there's pros and cons of each piece of it. So if you want to implement a more technical solution, it may not be feasible to go with design by a particular community because they may not have the skills or the resources needed for that. That may not be the most effective solution. But if you think about those three different approaches, it's important to recognize that any one of those could be possible, and it's about the trade-offs. I think that's the essence of the inclusive innovation and the participatory design approaches, is to really continuously ask the question, who should be speaking? Who's the expert? Who should be leading? And how do I create more space while recognizing power imbalances that already exist between the people in the room?
And I can imagine coming in with the students, that power structures navigation is an interesting dance, I guess, to do together. How do you start to do that with the students when you're coming into a new community?
Well, with the students, it starts from the classroom. So the students will start learning about this design mindset and these values and this approach and break down some of those assumptions that they have about their own expertise and what that means. And then over the course of the semester, as they're working with community partners on projects, they start to develop those skills. And then when they go and they travel and they spend time with people face to face, that's where it's sort of the rubber meets the road. We also have to recognize that coming from a place like the United States, coming from a university as prestigious as MIT, you really have to just be continuously aware that no matter how hard you try, there will always be those power dynamics that you want to acknowledge and find ways to adapt, whether it's through body language, whether it's through active listening, whether it's through ensuring that the students that travel maybe know the local language and can understand and make folks feel comfortable. The interesting thing is that about a quarter of the students that are engaged in MIT classes actually have an international background. They're international students. And so for many of them, this is normal. And so those students will often help to push some of that behavior and kind of remind those who maybe don't have as much experience traveling about how to really engage mindfully and thoughtfully with community partners.
You did grow up bridging two cultures, so between Serbia and the United States. How do you think that shaped the work that you feel called to do in the world?
I'd say it's been a lifelong journey of recognizing how much my background has affected me. I think one of the most interesting ways, I'll say, is through living and working and being educated in different systems, and then ultimately the research and the work that I did, I started to realize how different the kind of socialist systems and structures in the former Yugoslavia affected certain mindsets around expectations of responsibility and accountability for the government to provide certain things for citizens, and the citizens in turn to react and to respond and to do their civic duty. So I grew up in a world where there weren't the haves and the have-nots necessarily, or certainly not to the extent that you have in the United States. Nobody was excessively wealthy, and you sort of had what you needed for the most part. It was obviously very different during the war, but there was this expectation that education is important, culture is important, but you don't need to have an enormous house or a fancy car. That just wasn't part of the values that you were instilled with. And so in that system, things like social services or employment opportunities or education opportunities were not something that only the wealthy could afford. Conversely, being in the United States, a much more capitalist system, a lot of it was built around this, what I think today is more of a myth of you work hard. The American dream says you work really hard, you can achieve whatever you want. Well, we know that there's systemic and institutional constraints around that. But it also taught me to ask the question of ultimately who's going to pay for certain things? How do you make the numbers work out? How does the system allow you to make a living, and what are you offered? And so I remember when I did my doctoral research in Serbia, it was interesting because my field research was in Spanish in Latin America. My literature reading was all being done in English. And then my writing was being done in Serbian. And so I had three different languages coursing through my brain and three different worlds all kind of melting together. And when I was defending my dissertation, I got some interesting feedback that the questions that I asked around the sustainability, the financial sustainability of social services, and asking the question of private sector versus public sector responsibility were really questions that came from that American education, that were not questions. They were not questions that were necessarily being posed in Serbia at the time. And so that was really fascinating to me because I wasn't even aware of that. And so I'd say it's a lifelong process of discovery. You don't realize how different you are until somebody points it out in some way. But I think that there's only benefits that you can get from spending time in different cultures and systems. And you know that as well, having lived in different places around the world, just how surprising it can be sometimes when you're met with the acknowledgement that you have a certain way of thinking and you didn't even realize the bias that it stemmed from, because that's natural. That's your starting off point. So I think it's really helped me. I think it's allowed me to experience different cultures and integrate a lot more easily. particularly having lived in different places at a young age and having to adapt really quickly. I think that's been really helpful. It's certainly challenging. And I will say my sense of humor has suffered quite a bit. My jokes don't make sense in any, sometimes in any country.
Developed a very unique sense of humor. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm starting to have that challenge as well. So, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the differences. So you've worked in Serbia and Colombia and Uganda, and now you're based back in the US again. And you have a very global lens to your work. So spanning all of these different contexts, what have you seen that is similar in all of these places, despite on the surface looking so different?
I am still most fascinated by people who are able to make a lot with very little. I find resource constraints to be incredibly helpful when breeding innovation, no matter the country that you're in, because it makes it, it sharpens you. And so people who are experiencing poverty or who are living in an environment with constrained resources, I think exhibit incredible amounts of creativity and innovation. And so that I find no matter where I go. There are other things that I see around familial structures and support systems and love and laughter and joy that are present everywhere. I remember before moving to Colombia, trying to do some research. I'd never been there. I accepted a job there, not having ever spent time there. And when researching online, found that Colombians were consistently ranked among the happiest people in the world. And I wanted to understand why that was. And I think a lot of that has to do with the family structures and networks, with really seeing that life is short and you have to enjoy every day and dance it out. Don't be ashamed. Don't second guess what you're doing, and just really kind of living for the moment in a way that I think exhibits an appreciation for the world around you. And so I find that in all these cultures, you see pieces of that. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to sound naive and to say that, you know, when you see people like dancing and having fun, that they're not also really struggling and trying to figure out how they're going to pay for their kids' medicines or, you know, find a safe place to sleep at night. But I think that sense of hope and that sense of joy and that sense of support among communities is what sustains us and what really keeps us going when times are tough. And so I find that in all the different cultures that's something that's common and you can find no matter what part of the world you are, that kind of human kindness and compassion and generosity that I think is really critical.
At the end of the day, we're all human beings. And if we dig deep enough, we find a lot of similarities.
That's so true. And I think focusing on those rather than what distinguishes us from each other, yeah, I think is really important.
So your work integrates both international development and sustainable development. There's obviously a lot of overlap in these worlds, but they also have their kind of distinct histories and lenses as well. So what do you think these different spaces can learn from each other?
I remember I was in graduate school when I first learned about sustainable development, and I felt like all the pieces clicked together. And it was this moment of realization that we depend on all the three legs of the stool, if you will, to use the metaphor from sustainable development, that without a functioning planet, without functioning economic systems, and without the social aspect, without these three coming together, we fall apart. I think that sometimes in our education systems, we're pushed to gain expertise in one of them. And I think that obviously, there's value in that because you want to be able to go deep and have expertise in a particular area. But I also find that if you're only focused on that one leg, you won't be successful because there will be these other constraints that will start to affect you. And you'll notice, oh, well, I can't get funding for that, or that's not realistic, or the politics behind that just don't make sense. And so that awareness of the system dynamics and the structures and really the complexity of the work that we're doing is critical to success. So within sustainable development, I finally found a way of thinking that I think explains the interconnectedness and complexity of wanting to address some of the challenges, whether they're environmental or social or whatever. So to me, the work of international development or of sustainable development, I think has this just the strong foundation in systems that we don't necessarily focus on as much, and I think to our detriment. And so what that might lead to is the mindset of saying, well, I've developed this technology or approach, whether it's in agriculture or health or whatever, you know, whatever space you're working in, you may have the perfect solution. But again, if you're not thinking about the other pieces, you may likely come across some stumbling blocks. And so the most effective solutions I find are the ones that consider the systems. You don't have to be a systems designer. That doesn't have to be your focus. And in fact, again, it's without the technical depth and expertise in a particular area, we don't advance. But if that's not a lens that you carry with you, I don't think you can be successful. So for me, that was the kind of biggest takeaway from a research perspective and an academic perspective, and frankly, also from a practical one. I've spent most of my career working with governments. And if you don't find a way to accept that government bureaucracy is here to stay, if you don't find a way to design around those existing systems, you're just going to keep hitting your head against a wall. I think one important frame of mind is we think about, well, oh, governments are really slow and there's a lot of paperwork and there's all these pieces. But if you stop and put yourself in the shoes of a public servant and you realize these are taxpayer dollars and there's accountability, and if you don't follow the procedures, you could end up in jail or you could end up, you know, I mean, there's a reason why we have all these systems of accountability in place. So once you put yourself in the mindset of somebody who is working for this institution and understand their design constraints, then you can say, oh, okay, this might take a little bit longer, but it will lead to greater ownership and greater engagement and sustainability. And it won't be a solution that I bring in as an outsider. It'll be something that comes from within and is built in and incorporated from within by somebody who knows these systems better than I ever could. I think that that's a really important lens that we sometimes forget about.
And when we look in the development sector, I mean, we don't need to pull the curtain back very far to see the colonial legacy of international development and the international development systems that are in place. Could you speak more about how you see that showing up in your work and what you think decolonizing development might look like, or what might be some steps that we can take in that direction?
I think that it's such an important conversation we're having nowadays around decolonizing development, particularly for those coming from a European background where there is that colonial history. It's really important to reckon with that and to question why we engage and what we're hoping to achieve. I think at the end of the day, everyone always has motivations. It's not, again, it's not just altruism that causes us to invest time and money into addressing some of these issues. But when we have that mindset of decolonizing development, what that means to me is increasing local leadership and questioning where the funding should come from and understanding, going back to the example that I gave of asking the question of, well, you know, in the Serbian context, the expectation that public sector supports a lot of these social services in the United States, it's the private sector. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's multilaterals and banks that are coming in and financing a lot of these projects. So if we pull back and think about where the funding comes from, who's leading and setting the agenda for development in these countries, I think it's incredibly important that we question that and that we push for greater local ownership in the design of solutions and the leadership. And you're starting to see more philanthropic organizations seeking to have greater presence locally, seeking to not only have offices that are based in the countries where they work, but also more leadership from the staff that are from those countries. And I have to say, from a personal perspective, working in an organization where I was a foreigner, but I was paid the same as my local colleagues, where I had the same kind of systems set up in place. And we were much more equal. I also spoke the same language as them. It felt a lot better than working within the UN system, where I was an international with greater privileges and salaries and protections, et cetera. I felt a lot more integrated and a lot closer to the realities on the ground, and actually worked really hard to try to acknowledge those power imbalances, to call them out and to adapt them, whether it was through the way that I engaged with our government partners, whether it was the advocacy that I was doing for our local implementing organizations and saying they know the realities of some of the challenges that are faced by the adolescent girls in urban areas that we were supporting so much better than I ever could. I need to step back. They need to shine. Their voices need to be heard. And so that was one of the critical things from the communication standpoint, from the design standpoint, was always to put that local leadership front and center. And I thought that that was critical to living your values and engaging in development in a way that is truthful and honest and ultimately going to be more successful and sustainable.
It also takes a lot of working with yourself to overcome any sort of, yeah, triggers or defensiveness or anything that might come up and cause you to take up that space that you want to offer to others.
For sure. And sometimes we say, oh, I know the solution. You get really excited. You're like, oh, we can fix this. And it's very difficult to pull yourself back and to wait and say, okay, this might not even be the right solution. And then you may have just introduced bias inadvertently. So to pull back, hold back, it's sometimes the most challenging thing.
Yeah, it takes a lot of inner work, that's for sure. I wanted to ask you about this because it's something I've experienced myself. Sometimes when you are working in a lot of different cultures and moving around a lot, you can come to this challenge of feeling at home everywhere and nowhere, which obviously has its upside and sometimes its downside. I was wondering how that is for you, and what have you learned about finding or building home for yourself wherever you are?
That's such an interesting question. I think about this in two ways. One is that there's sort of that temporal question of, do you know how long you're going to be in a place and how much you treat it as a temporary situation? So when I was younger and I moved to the United States and then I would move back to Serbia, there was no hard stop on when I would be in those places. And so that was home and that was it. And you don't think about this ability to, oh, well, I can leave whenever I want to. That wasn't an option. And as a result, I think that really pushed me to want to integrate into the culture, make friends, build community. And it also made it very difficult to not miss certain things about that other home or that other place. I've found that that's translated a bit in my career. When I lived in Colombia, it was a similar thing where I really felt like I integrated, I made local friends. I didn't have this thought of, well, home is elsewhere. But living in Uganda, and maybe that had to do with working for the UN, one of the first things that people would ask me was, how long are you here for? And I found that to be such a jarring question. It's this acknowledgement that as international workers in these systems, you're typically only there for a short amount of time, and then you move on to the next place. So people question whether they should invest in those relationships. So that was a really big surprise for me, and one that made me feel less comfortable being in that environment. Also acknowledging that I wasn't learning the local language, and that I knew even if I wanted to, you can't, as an international staff member, you're not allowed to stay for longer than a certain number of years. You could certainly transition jobs, find a way to, you know, find your home there, but that wasn't the expectation. And so I really appreciated the ability to integrate into the local culture, make a place feel like home. And that to me was really important. But outside of that, you know, when you're in different places, home is kind of what you take with you. When I moved to the States, my parents stayed behind, and that was really hard to be, you know, 8 or 9 years old and have your parents be on the other side of the world and you can't talk to them. You can't, you know, hug them. But I think I was infused with so much love from an early age that I carried that with me no matter where I went. And I still do. My parents passed about a decade ago, but I still have them with me, you know, even though they're on a different planet. And I think that that's something that's so important. So if you can find a way to hold that love, that joy, those memories, those pieces of you, and call them back up, you'll find home no matter where you are. And then I really lucked out in life through my family and now through my home here and my husband to have found a different kind of community and a certain extra special amount of joy coming home every day and getting to see him that I missed when we were apart when I was living in Uganda. So I don't ever take that for granted. And I think that that's so important. So try to find those moments and whatever they are for you, those moments of joy that transport you back to a place. A lot of it is nowadays putting on some Latin music and dancing around in the kitchen or walking down the street, listening to beats that maybe you were dancing to 10 years ago in Colombia. And it just transports you back to a place and a time and infuses you with joy. So whatever that is for you, try to hold on to those and you'll find home wherever you are, whether it's food or music or hugs. It's all the good things in life.
Yeah, I was just thinking that for me, definitely food and music has that incredible transportive power. So we talked a little bit before about how working on these participatory and inclusive design approaches is central to your work. What's that taught you about participatory and inclusive leadership?
Well, I will say that I think that that's one of the toughest things in life, to step back and allow others to take the lead means that you're giving up a certain sense of control over the outcomes. There's a lot of pressure that we experience in terms of accountability and results and delivering that don't always lend themselves well to participatory leadership. And there are certain times where it's not the best approach. You know, we sometimes say, oh, this is the best way because it's the most democratic. But there are certain times where not everybody has the same information or are aware of some of the same design constraints. And I find it really challenging to be a participatory and inclusive leader when working around those constraints. So, for example, if every decision requires, or if you try to achieve consensus with every decision, I think what you end up with sometimes is an outcome that everybody can live with, but really isn't necessarily optimal. And the hope is that as a leader, you can gain the trust of your employees and partners to know that you're acting in their best interest and to try to communicate certain principles for why you made decisions, but also acknowledge that you can't always disclose all those pieces of it. And so whether it's in a work environment or even within a particular project where you say, I understand that you may want to work on this particular area, but the funder only funds these three topics. So unfortunately, we have to focus on those. And you can try to push back with the funder all you want, but you'll lose time and energy. And so I think that with design thinking, we get so excited by the endless possibilities. And as somebody who has spent their whole life implementing those, it's very challenging to keep that open mindset and to say, let's let all these ideas flow. Let's try all these, when you know from the start that half of them are just going to be impossible because of the design constraints. So I tend to prefer setting those parameters out and to know that it's not always going to be possible, because I think it's a little bit more time efficient. But ultimately, we do want to strive towards a working environment where we are more participatory, where everybody's voice is heard. And what that translates into is inviting more people into the conversations so that they can also learn about those design constraints and be aware of them as well, and have that practical experience so that they can be more effective designers in the end as well.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly important for the students to see as well. And thinking about that and the fact that you do work with so many young people, I'm wondering, what are you learning from them about how to facilitate and lead change in the context that you work?
Yeah, I think young people come in with such a mindset of kind of optimism and possibility. And I think all of us over time, the more experience you have, I find the more experience that you have, the less kind of blue sky thinker you are. I think a lot of that comes with the privilege of how you grew up. If you grew up with a safety net, you're more likely to be an entrepreneur because you know you have something to fall back on. If you grew up in poverty, it's much more difficult to push yourself to be this blue sky thinker. And so with students, it's the constraints are a lot less present and their excitement to pursue different pathways is just incredible. And so I love that they're active learners all the time. Their curiosity is really infectious. And to see them get excited by things that you've seen so many times and you see it happening for the first time, you know, it really heartens the spirit. And for a lot of students, that first time abroad, that first time experiencing the challenges of navigating the world outside of your bubble on your own, they grow up so quickly. And it reminds me of, you know, well, that happened to me too. And it's incredible that we're able to provide this for others. So I really enjoy seeing that. That's one of the cool parts of my job.
Sometimes I wish I had have bottled some of my youthful optimism so I can take some shots of it. So, you know, you've always struck me as a very energized and, let's say, person very connected to their joy. And I'm interested to know, what do you do to keep your connection to energy and joy, given that you do work on complex and sometimes, I'm sure, overwhelming challenges?
Oh, goodness. I think that reminding yourself to look for those is incredibly important. There's so many days that I would come home and be so frustrated that I can't solve all the challenges in the world. And the thing that I struggle with all the time when working in complex systems is to narrow down the parameters. Something as big as, you know, writing my dissertation, I didn't know where to start. I didn't know how to tackle it. I wanted to do everything all at once, and ultimately would find myself the first week or so just sitting in the library for 12 hours staring at my computer screen. And you just have to wait for that moment of, okay, let's start with this. Let's try this. Let's, you know, advance a little bit. And once you start to see those little results and take pride and joy in them, you feel better. And I think when you stop and realize everything that you have and you put your life in context, I think so many of us have more privileges than many people could ever dream of. I feel incredibly privileged to be able to do the work that I do, to be able to live a life that's values led, to be able to continue to learn, to be in the kinds of spaces where we can have open conversations, to be a woman in a country where my rights are somewhat protected, to feel a sense of safety and security. And the more you travel around the world, the more you embrace the privilege of where you are, because you can contrast it to different experiences. So I think that that's incredibly important. And the other thing is just to embrace and accept what it is that brings you joy. I love musical theater, and I just lose myself in a musical and am unapologetic about it. And I sometimes enjoy some lowbrow music with a good beat and just rocking it. And that's okay. I think we take ourselves too seriously sometimes, and you just got to also enjoy the, not to say the musical theater is not serious. It is. It's a very impressive art form. And absolutely, it's perfectly normal to be walking down the street and break out into song and dance and to sing about the world that you're experiencing. It's just another way that we express ourselves. So just find whatever it is that brings you joy and to make sure you're taking time for it.
Amazing. You work with a lot of students and young people. If you had a message for any young women looking to move into international development, sustainable development, and make a positive impact in the world, what would you like them to know?
I would love for them to know that they can absolutely do whatever they want, that they shouldn't wait until they have enough experience or enough education or that they've met all the qualifications as required in the job posting. Just apply and go for it. It took, in my case, it took a man nudging me to apply for a job that brought me to Columbia when I didn't have the required experience, didn't have the required skills, but I had all these other things that weren't even listed on there. And I just went and applied, and it completely changed my world. It led to this incredible career, and I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't had somebody encourage me to do it and have me question that one piece of paper and that one requirement. And so I think you never know where a certain door pathway will lead you. It could be amazing. It could be terrible. But if you don't go and try it out, you'll never know. So buckle up. Don't be afraid. Pack your suitcase and get going. There's a big world out there, and we need more strong, independent, creative, thoughtful, kind, generous, brilliant women in leadership positions.
Amazing. I'd like to ask all of my podcast guests, because the podcast is called The Grateful, what does living a great and full life mean for you?
Living a great and full life to me means being able to live your values every day in every way. And I feel very privileged to have found a place where I can do that, where I can live my values through my work, in my personal life, that I can be my authentic self and that I don't have to compromise is a luxury and a privilege and something I don't take for granted and I'm grateful for every day. Values-driven life is an exceptional privilege to have, and it brings me joy every day.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of The Grateful Podcast. It's been wonderful to have you here. And if our conversation has left you thinking it would be great to have some support on your leadership journey to create sustainable change, then I just wanted to let you know that applications are now open for the next round of the Be the Change program. Be the Change is a 4-month leadership and group coaching program where women from around the world come together to explore what it means to lead sustainable change from the inside out. We start by exploring how change begins inside each of us and build some really practical habits and tools that allow us to have a healthy foundation for the work that we want to do in the world. We then look at the role of community and communication so that we can collaborate with others to bring about change. And we wrap up the program exploring callings and courage. What's that unique place where your strengths intersect with a need in the world to allow you to make an impact in a way that's both sustainable and fulfilling? All of this happens in a wonderful learning community that's incredibly motivating and inspiring. And if you'd love to learn more about this, then head to www.thegrateful.com/be the change. And I'll pop that link in the show notes for you so you can easily find out more if you're interested. And you can always reach out to me directly via podcast@thegrateful.com. If you want to learn more about the program, or if you have a guest or a topic that you would love us to explore here. Thanks so much for being here.